TikTok, tech support for unemployment systems, how to actually fight mega fires, and trying to agree on what is true. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 21st night of September, and it's good to have you with us. Let's start today with TikTok and the unprecedented forced sale of a foreign-owned company to an American one. In this case, two American companies. The Trump administration announced Sunday that the tech firm Oracle and the retailer Walmart will take a stake in TikTok and create a new entity headquartered in the United States. Now, there are still a lot of questions about national security and user data, especially since Chinese owner ByteDance remains the majority stakeholder, and the U.S.-based entity may not actually control the underlying technology. We actually don't know for sure yet. So for today, let's put on our business hats and look at what Oracle and Walmart would get out of the deal. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports.
For Oracle, this is really about growing its cloud storage business. It rents server space to other companies, like Zoom and soon TikTok, so they can store their data. But that business is a lot smaller than its cloud competitors. John Freeman at CFRA Research says Amazon, Google, and Microsoft have a lot of very large data centers, and that's an asset.
An entire data center can go down. They can keep on chugging. That's the kind of reliability that you get when you have that kind of scale.
So he says getting bigger, thanks to this TikTok deal, could help Oracle land even more high-profile, lucrative contracts. As for Walmart, this partnership is also about data, the kind TikTok collects on its users. Leigh Duran is a senior VP at Kantar.
They are tracking engagement, time spent, what you're looking at, where you came from, and then any click-throughs.
That could help Walmart figure out what's trendy, particularly among the people who tend to use TikTok. You know, the youths. Adam Pressman is a managing director at Alex Partners.
With TikTok, you're getting a global audience with highly engaged users in a demographic that retailers across the world are seeking to better understand.
There is some risk here for both companies. John Freeman at CFRA says, sure, TikTok is the hot social media app right now, but maybe in a couple years.
You know, TikTok's 10-year-old to 18-year-old demographic, you know, uses Micmac or Loop Loop or something, you know, whatever, right? Whatever the next flavor of cool mobile app is, right?
Also, buying a stake in TikTok could put both companies in the middle of the endless fights between the U.S. and China over technology and everything else. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
We turn now to the COVID economy. Hundreds of thousands of Californians are still waiting to receive unemployment benefits, 3 weeks or longer after applying for them. That's according to a special commission that Governor Gavin Newsom appointed to look into the state's unemployment system. In fact, the governor's so-called strike team documented so many problems that it actually told the state to stop accepting new applications for 2 weeks while California catches up and starts working on a new system. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, these problems are not just happening in California.
The surge in jobless claims revealed some deep-seated problems with California's unemployment system. Among them, antiquated software and a glitchy ID verification system for preventing fraud. These kinds of problems have surfaced nationwide since the pandemic hit, says Michael Strain at the American Enterprise Institute.
It's not a surprise that it was a shock to the system.
In a matter of weeks in March, claims nationwide jumped from around 200,000 to more than 6 million and have remained historically high ever since. Strain says states underinvested in their unemployment systems for decades before the pandemic.
The IT infrastructure that many states are using is, you know, really outdated and needs to be upgraded.
Every state runs its own unemployment system with different eligibility rules and application processes. Michelle Evermore at the National Employment Law Project points out, in some states, to reset your password, you have to call in and get a new one sent in the mail. Her list of fixes starts with more uniform national standards.
Having the IT system be able to reset your password, having it be open 24/7, making sure that you can upload forms with a mobile device, being able to get information easily about where you are in the process.
The current system isn't serving its primary function for many laid-off workers, says University of Oklahoma economist Gary Hoover, namely providing income so they can keep paying their bills. And that's hitting the workers who need it the most the hardest.
People at the bottom of the income distribution, women, minorities, are going to be damaged even more so than the general public.
He says those workers have less in the way of assets to tide them over until the next job comes along. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a big BuzzFeed news report had markets rattled. Leaked documents showed that the world's biggest banks seem to have ignored some $2 trillion in suspicious transactions, you know, dirty money, and there may be more bombshells coming. Bank stocks dropped, and so did the rest of the market. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Already this year, California has battled some of its largest wildfires in state history. And yes, a changing climate is one big reason for these infernos, but another reason is fire policy. Decades of suppressing what's called good fire, the smaller forest fires away from homes and communities that help clear the wildland so there's less to burn. Scientists and fire experts have been advocating, actually begging, for good fire for decades as a way to prevent the massive devastation like we're seeing today. Elizabeth Wiles, a reporter for ProPublica, who recently wrote about preventing megafires. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
You spoke with all these experts who have been advocating for good fire, for prescribed burns for decades.
Yes.
And nobody disagrees, right? You found that there is no scientific disagreement that this is the way to prevent megafires. So how come it never happens?
You know, that's a really good question. I talked to a lot of scientists who have been talking about this, as you said, literally for decades. And it's been really painful to watch the West burn. It hasn't been happening because people don't like smoke. It hasn't been happening because of very well-intended environmental regulations like the Clean Air Act that make it harder to put particulate matter in the air from man-made causes. It hasn't happened because of where we live. You don't want to burn down people's houses, obviously.
Right. Well, and then talk to me about the money, because you also uncovered a lot of business incentive, a lot of financial incentive not to prescribe burn or behind fighting fires.
Yes, it's really complicated. So first, there's the lumber industry, which is huge business. So people have a lot of money invested in trees that are out there, and obviously they want to protect those assets. And it's also just a huge apparatus. There's essentially an army of firefighters, and like all armies, there's just tons of money flowing through contracts and airplanes and housing, and it's a job. So it's an incredibly important job, and it's a job that serves the public interest to great extent, but it also has its own momentum.
And so that momentum, I mean, I guess what you're saying is when we hear a headline that says this is a $1 billion fire season, we should remember on some level that $1 billion went somewhere to the makers of big airplanes or helicopters, that kind of thing.
Yes, that $1 billion went somewhere. It went to contracting out airplanes. And I think a really important point to keep in mind is it went to fighting fires, not all of which need to be fought. You know, a lot of the fire ecologists I spoke to feel we have been doing way too much fire suppression for way too long. So we need to let fires that aren't going to impact structures and aren't going to threaten lives. A lot of those fires, a lot of scientists feel, we should be allowing to just burn in their own natural patterns.
One thing that has come up recently is this question of whose job it is to do these prescribed burns or to stop policies around fire suppression, whether it's the state or federal government. Who should be doing this?
Well, there's state land, there's federal land. It's a whole patchwork of ownership. So there's the question of what government entities should be doing it. And then there's just also a big cultural question of how we use and relate to fire. As a lot of people have been talking about, Indigenous Californians had a very different and healthier relationship to fire than most of us do now. They sort of used fire to take care of the landscape. And also, in different parts of the country, people have different relationships to fire. There's a lot more prescribed burning that happens in the Southeast, and it happens with people who take what are called burn boss certification programs so they can take care of their own property. And so another argument is we need to get back to a place where fire isn't just in the hands of firefighting professionals, where it's something that more people know how to use responsibly.
Now that we are pretty firmly in an era of mega fires, I mean, at least in California, the last 3 years have had giant, devastating fire seasons. Do you think there's a likelihood that we'll see any change in these policies?
I do. I'm pretty hopeful at the moment. I think there's political momentum. It's an issue that is fairly bipartisan, and it's something that we can do. Attacking climate change head on is such a gigantic problem. And while better landscape management is also a big problem, it's at a far different scale, and it's at a scale that we can actually do something about in the near future.
Elizabeth Weil is a reporter for ProPublica. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
Just a few months ago, there were meat shortages around the country as packing plants shut down due to COVID outbreaks. Grocery stores were limiting purchases. Meat prices were soaring. Now we've got the opposite problem. More meat than people may be able to eat. The surplus has been building for months as restaurants, hotels, and other businesses that feed people remain closed or only partly open. Marketplace's Erica Barris reports.
When most of us started staying home, there was an immediate surplus of meat. Cafeterias, airports, arenas, all mostly closed or were barely open. Chris Muller is a hospitality consultant.
Think of how much food was consumed in a football stadium on a Sunday with 70,000 people in it.
That meat is distributed differently than the meat we typically buy in supermarkets. So that meat got repackaged and sent to grocery stores. But it turns out people don't eat the same stuff at home as they do when they go out. Then meatpacking plants closed down when workers got sick. That left livestock lingering on farms and feedlots, just waiting.
Now that we've gotten the production levels back up to normal, we have to process those materials for meat production, because there's really no other way that we could repurpose that livestock.
That's Ohio State University Supply Chain Management Professor Terry Espers. So more meat and lower prices, and not just in supermarkets. Michelle Derpetti manages Chicago steakhouse Jean and Giorgetti. Before the pandemic, she was spending around $31 a pound for a steak fillet. Now it's down to about $24 a pound.
In normal times, this would be a much different discussion, because anytime meat prices drop and you can still do the volume, that's a good thing.
Right now, her restaurant's two locations are open, but she isn't doing the volume. She's buying 75% less meat than she was before the pandemic. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's one thing to be seeing all this information online. It's another thing to go out in public and represent it.
How fake news hits the streets and possibly the voting booth. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial dropped 509 points, 1.8% to finish at 27,147. The NASDAQ fell 14 points, 0.1%, to end at 10,778. And the S&P 500 lost 38 points, 1.1%, to land at 3,281. All that is still just the regular down music. Mariel Segarra reported on what Oracle and Walmart might get out of a partnership to take over TikTok's U.S. business. On Wall Street, investors looked at that potential social and retail mashup, and Walmart picked up 1.3%, Oracle conjured 1.7%, Amazon found 0.1%. Why not? Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 0.67%, and you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. During the peak of the coronavirus pandemic this past spring, the highest number of Chicago deaths were in Black and Latinx zip codes, the lowest in wealthy white ones. It's a story that mirrors the rest of the country. Systemic racism, higher rates of essential workers in these areas, underlying health conditions, and overcrowding are all factors, and it's not just numbers. This is the real tragedy of this virus. WBEZ's Natalie Moore in Chicago has the story.
32-year-old Jillian Woodbury was proud of her smile and kept a toothbrush in her purse. She lived in a Southside Chicago nursing home for people with mental disabilities. In mid-April, staff took her to a nearby hospital to treat a urinary tract infection. Jillian tested positive for COVID-19. Jillian was in the hospital for 5 days. Her aunt and guardian, Patricia Woodbury, says she talked to Jillian in the hospital daily. But on day 6, when Woodbury hadn't heard from Jillian, she became concerned. She says she called the hospital and reached a nurse who said Jillian was unavailable. The next time Woodbury heard from the hospital was in the wee hours of the next morning.
The phone rang at 3 o'clock and they said she had took a turn for the worse. And I live down the street from the hospital, so I was down there in 15 minutes.
When Patricia arrived at South Shore Hospital, Jillian had died of COVID-19. The family is concerned with the lack of communication by the nursing home and hospital, neither of which agreed to an interview. Nicole Marshall is Jillian's cousin and says her hospital care was inadequate.
While it technically isn't an issue of race because the majority of families that end up going there are Black. And in the minds of some, that means you're disposable.
Jillian, who was Black, lived in a zip code that had the highest number of COVID deaths in the city between the months of March and May. Half of them were in for-profit nursing homes. But there were other deaths as well. Philip Thomas, who was also Black, was an essential worker who lived in the same zip code as Jillian. He took the bus to his job at Walmart. In March, he felt sick and stayed home, says his sister, Angela McMiller.
The doctor told him to self-quarantine himself, which I'm super upset about that, because my brother was a diabetic.
Her brother went to South Shore Hospital, the same one Jillian went to, and tested positive for COVID-19. A few days later, his heart stopped and he died. Monica Peake is a doctor at the University of Chicago who teaches and sees patients and researches racial health disparities.
There's no better perfect storm for pandemics sort of sweeping through our very segregated city based on race and class.
WBEZ studied the death and infection rates of 4 zip codes in Chicago and interviewed relatives of 50 Chicago residents who died. One zip code had either mostly Black or Latinx residents. The zip code with Black residents had the highest deaths per capita. The zip code that includes a Latinx and immigrant neighborhood had the highest infection rate. There, loved ones said their family members who died were either infected at work or became infected after working relatives brought the virus into their multi-generational households. WBEZ also looked at 2 high-income zip codes with white residents that had the lowest rates of death in the city. Jillian's cousin, Nicole Marshall, used to babysit Jillian when she was little. This is the last voicemail Jillian left her big cousin.
Hi, Nikki. This is Jill. I'm going to talk to check on you and the kids and Kenny. How's everybody doing?
Those kids were Marshall's young children, and Jillian loved to play with them. In Chicago, I'm Natalie Moore for Marketplace.
From Russian propaganda campaigns to myths about COVID-19, social media is unquestionably the vector for dangerous misinformation. And with an election just 42 days away and starting already in some states, Americans are deeply divided on, well, the truth. So misinformation poses a very real threat to our democracy. Joan Donovan is the research director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard. She works with policymakers, journalists, and companies on ways to fight and debunk misinformation online. I spoke with her recently about the scale of the problem, and I started by asking her about the rise of the conspiracy theory QAnon.
Because the infrastructure of QAnon and the networks were already in place during the pandemic, that feature of social media that brings these groups together through the use of hashtags is something that has accelerated medical misinformation and really grown the ranks of people who are familiar with QAnon. And it's one thing to be seeing all this information online. It's another thing to go out in public and represent it and to show up at public protests. And these newer manifestations of reopen protests, as well as MAGA rallies, and now these Save the Children rallies, are indicative of folks that are mobilizing on disinformation as a catalyst.
So does that raise the stakes for the platforms? I mean, I feel like one of the things they've always been able to say is that the link between maybe misinformation and real world action was a little bit tenuous.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you go back and you look at the lore that they told themselves about specifically Twitter and Facebook and YouTube about being this open forum, this public square, They really rode the reputation of movements into cultural significance. And as a company, you can't market yourself as being at the forefront of these social movements and then at the same time not take responsibility for the negative consequences of white nationalist organizing, for instance.
Right. You don't get to take credit for the Arab Spring and Black Lives Matter and then pretend that it's a shock that QAnon would be growing.
Exactly. And so This is why it's been really difficult for researchers like myself to get these platforms to understand that the content and not necessarily the behaviors are part of the problem. But, you know, for the last 4 years, I've been banging on the door of every one of these platform companies to say the design of your systems is not built for authoritative information. It's not built to serve timely, local, and relevant information to people like local news organizations would be doing. And so we have to reconfigure how we use social media to account for that.
Do you think that we're headed toward a flashpoint where people will re-recognize the value of information? Or do you think it's sort of going to be like a long, slow decline into little islands of personal truth?
It's a really good question. You know, if you asked me this 10 years ago, I'd say the capacity for the internet to ensure that we have hyper-local information networks is at an all-time high, if you think back to the days of indie media. However, because we've reached this obligatory passage point where information networks have become consolidated within these super large companies, we have to rethink data as currency, and we have to rethink data infrastructures and figure out a public component to this infrastructure that doesn't leave us at the mercy of social media companies. I've been a big proponent of using librarians. You know, they keep talking about content moderators. I'm like, what about your curation process? So that when you do look for information on Google or on Facebook, that you're getting things that have been vetted, not just things that are popular or new.
Joan Donovan is the research director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This final note on the way out, it was announced today that the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg will lie in state at the U.S. Capitol building on Friday. Fittingly, given that so much of her career was devoted to equality and justice for women, she will in fact become the first woman to lie in state at the Capitol. So let's just set everything aside for a moment to acknowledge that that is actually pretty darn appropriate. Your moment of economic context on a Monday, also about Walmart. The world's largest retailer said it would emit zero carbon by 2040 and restore millions of acres of land and ocean by 2030. Climate watchers pointed out that this is good policy that is also a heck of a lot cheaper in the long run than fossil fuels. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.